Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This episode of Pardes Live and Miniseries features Rav Mike Foyer. For more information on how to download more podcasts, visit elmod.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, PARDES.org.IL, for helping make this class happen. Okay, good morning, everybody. You guys ready to get going back into the flow of history? So we are still struggling in the aftermath of the expulsion, as I mentioned we would be. Just a reminder, we took a look at Italian Jewry, and I didn't wrap it up into a neat bow, and we're going to keep touching it. But this idea of the humanism, both in the side of the birth, or let's say a brief flowering of Jewish historiography, and this idea of a cultural fusion which took place within Italian Jewry, those are ways that we deal with historic tragedy, trying to fit them into some theological or philosophical framework of understanding how things occur in the past and where we got to in the present, and also what I was calling up-leveling, trying to sort of deepen our commitment to the universal human values which are deeply violated by tragedy in order not to try to fall into sort of the very dark sides of the us and them identity, which always sort of, actually I was going to say always lays lurking at the edges of Jewish identity, but frankly, often underpins it. And it's a question just to remind you of today and not just the past. Today what I would like to do is begin a discussion of the converso identity. Right, what do the people who actually experienced not just the expulsion, but the forced conversion and the cultural imprint of Catholicism, what do they have to add to our story in general? And they're going to play a very important role from here, I'll say, like all the way through Spinoza, if not further, but certainly in terms of really shaping the story, definitely through Spinoza. And how do they represent the immediate response to this historical tragedy? So that's what we're going to do today, and I think that we're going to start with a story that I almost told last week, if you guys recall, but I decided I didn't want to rush it, which is the story of David Ruvaini and really Shlomo Molcho. Really Shlomo Molcho is the person of interest. David Ruvaini is an exciting, interesting character, but he actually is not quite as significant. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, this is it. Diogo Pires was born in Portugal, right outside Lisbon, in 1501. Right? He was... What? You want me to put his name up there? My Portuguese is a little rusty, so if I mispronounce anything, you'll forgive me. He was born in 1501 as a new Christian, the Nuevos Cristos, right? And which is the sort of general term originated in Spain for Jews that were forcibly converted. Now, it's interesting, I don't want to go into the whole thing, we discussed it quite a bit at length last year, but it's interesting to note that the Catholic Church, though it doesn't advocate at this point forced conversion, does recognize its efficacy, right? Meaning it works, you shouldn't do it. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. But politically and culturally, the Iberian cultures, both Spanish and Portuguese, are not so fond of the Jews, who used to be outsiders, competitors, economically competitors, culturally, competitors, even politically, now becoming insiders and the final barrier to their success falling once they are converted. So therefore, one of the sort of cultural, political responses is to label these people as new Christians. And those of you who were with us last year will recall that many of the elements of racial anti-Semitism, which are often associated with the 19th century and the rise of political anti-Semitism and the ideologies of nationalism, etc., which is correct, many of the elements of it are actually born in the Iberian Peninsula. And this idea that particularly in Spain, what were known as the limpieza de sangre laws, the purity of blood laws, that it's in order to hold certain positions within the church or within the nobility, you had to be able to prove four generations of Christian ancestry. And this idea that Jewish blood has a taint to it originates in the Iberian Peninsula. But that's just a side point. For our purposes, the King of Portugal was quite happy. And at this point, it's King Manuel. Manuel, I think, the first. I didn't write down a number after his name, but we'll just call him King Manuel. He was doing everything good after this forced conversion to integrate these new Christians into his sort of new realm. Why? Because they're a big source of income. And second of all, there's still that old rule. Loyal, diligent, you know, very, very talented, and easily discardable. He's using them to undermine the nobility. And so, when a young man like Diogo Perez is born in 1501, that's only 4 years after this conversion, but he's born as a Nuevo Cristo, he's not circumcised. Even though, by the way, at this early stage, remember, these are the Jews who withstood 100 years of persecution in Spain, and then decided to leave instead of converting, which means their commitment to Judaism is quite profound. And therefore, a sort of pro forma mass conversion doesn't wipe that out. What happens is underground culture. And I want you to just keep that phrase in mind, underground culture. Right? This is the heart and soul of the converso consciousness. Outwardly, I look like one thing. Inside, I'm another, which is going to plant some very profound questions about where identity resides. Questions which sound very familiar to us today. Because, you know, in the Middle Ages, identity was largely what we would call a corporate identity. Not like suit and tie corporate, but in the sense of collective. You're a Jew because you're part of that communal group. You're Jew also largely in medieval Europe because you're visually identifiable as a Jew, either because you choose to or because the Christian world has forced you to wear, remembering that the idea of yellow badges of the Nazis also has its roots in Catholic practice. Back in 1215 already, the church passed the laws that the Jews had to wear an identifiable mark on their clothing. Right? This is not a new thing in Europe. So therefore, corporate identity is largely based on your outward appearance. What we say today, how one presents. Right? But the converso identity will be based on the exact opposite, which is how one identifies, a language which has become much more familiar to us today. And the tension between how one presents and how one identifies, if you've been reading the news, or maybe people here find that struggle familiar within themselves, is a very fundamental psychological tension, because part of identity is held by society. There's no way around that. Even in the most sort of progressive, postmodern, deconstructed models of society, you can't get away from the fact that we all offload our identity onto social models. The way we dress, the language we choose, the way we present our gender or don't present our gender, meaning all these things are acts of allegiance, conscious or unconscious, to an identity. However, many of us would probably say, you know, don't label me, don't judge a book by its cover, don't, your parents always told you, don't judge a person by how they dress. You know, all these things which are, on one hand, useful, on the other hand, are what? Confining. But these things are true. Like, what do you mean, don't judge a book by its cover? What other option do you have? As an author, I can tell you what, people judge books by their cover. That's why we all put so much effort into the art that we put there, right? And in the same way, as I've tried to tell my children, even though they defy me in every way possible in this respect, is that just people will judge you by what you dress, what you wear. You can say it's not fair, you can rail against the system, you can do whatever you want, but you're not going to change basic psychology. The first thing I encounter is a visual image. Now, I may decide then to pause and get to know you, but you can't, you know, there's never a second chance to make a first impression. That's just the way it is. No, it's true, right? So the world into which Diogo Perez is born is a world of deep tension. On one hand, you've got these Jews who are deeply committed Jews who've just undergone a pro forma mass conversion, and therefore inside, and not just internally, but it seems even in terms of learning, in terms of practice, there are recorded, I was reading some letters recently, they're translations, they're not really primary documents, but whatever, translations of primary documents about how careful the Jews of Portugal were with Erev Tafshilin. If you're familiar with that particular rabbinic approach to how one deals with the problem of Yom Tov that comes out before Shabbat, yeah, that tells you the level of the culture. If you're not just, it's a very particular structure of rabbinic law. And the fact that they were concerned about it shows you that there was a level of learning and commitment which persisted, even though outwardly they were all going to church, taking communion. Some of them were serving within the church hierarchy, you know. So this is the world into which he's born, and he's not circumcised. Why? Because that, of course, is the most obvious outward sign of allegiance, and it would get you kicked out of any respectable church or position that you could have. And position is very important because Diogo Perez, by all accounts, is extremely intelligent, rises very quickly within the royal service and becomes, by 1521, a judge in the Royal Appeals Court, which is, at that point, the highest... 20 years old. Yeah, 20 years old. Yeah. And, according to later testimony, seems to have also mastered a significant amount of rabbinic and mystic wisdom as well. Again, on the inside, he is a Jew. On the outside, he's not just a new Christian, he is holder of one of the highest judicial offices in the land. This is the court that travels with the king and is the highest recourse to justice they have. You have a question or comment?
I'm a little confused with that. Does people obviously don't know that England was Jewish.
That's a big question. There is no, thank you for the question, meaning how do you get away with it? So one answer is the Jews are all in it together, underground culture. Like I said, I used to work with at-risk youth in a wilderness therapy program for a couple of years, a different life. And our big challenge was what we call underground culture. And sometimes when you unearth something, somebody's got possession of something or there's some sort of like plot going on, et cetera, you discover like, how could I not have known this when everybody else in the campsite knew this? And the answer is that's what an underground is. Right? So that's one answer. The other answer is it seems that, remember, the Inquisition, I actually failed to write it here, the Inquisition doesn't come to Portugal until 1536. This is don't ask, don't tell policy. The king's not really interested in what you do in your home. That's in Spain. The Inquisition doesn't come to Portugal until 1536. We're in Portugal right now. And the king knows that what he just did was whitewash a large group of extremely wealthy, extremely useful servants, and now has a vested interest into integrating them into his administration in order, why? To undermine the nobility. Because remember, at this point in European history, the great struggle is between church, king, and aristocracy. The landed aristocracy, specifically. Because the sort of arc of progress we're moving toward is ultimately the rise of the nation state, which does what? It takes the power of church and nobility and concentrates them into what? First into the king, in what we call the enlightened despot model, then ultimately into the state, which replaces the king. So that process of concentration of power, you'll see that the Jews will play a very important role. They played a very important role in Ferdinand and Isabella, who ultimately rewarded them with their mass conversion and expulsion. They played a very important role in the concentration of power into Ferdinand and Isabella's hands that allowed them to expel all the Jews. We spoke about that at length last year. And I pointed out to you that it's always important to note that Jews historically have gravitated toward absolute power because the multipolar world, be it multipolar Christianity when the Reformation breaks out from the Catholic world, or the multipolar feudal structure as opposed to the kingship, that's where the risks really were involved. But if you can get close to absolute power, well, then I can just deal one-on-one. And I'm a very useful servant, says the Jew. And power knows that. This may sound familiar. So at this point, first of all, don't ask, don't tell. King's not interested. Second of all, an underground is indeed an underground. And third of all, they're just succeeding. And nothing proves like success, right? You can get away with an awful lot if you succeed. So in the early 1520s, it's by the way, also important, let's not make it all so rosy. The reason I put the Lisbon Massacre here is that the mob is always there as well. You recall that the Lisbon Massacre was a tremendous, what we would call today, pogrom, where potentially thousands, it's hard to know from the documentation, potentially thousands of Jews were killed because the average Catholic is not so pleased at these new questionable additions to their community of faith. So therefore, gravitate toward the king and power because it's his troops that will keep you safe. So, like I said, by all accounts, he seems to be, as we'd say in Jewish, dancing at two weddings and holding it. And this is part of the question and we'll never be able to answer, but this is a question I give to you. But what's the psychology that develops in a situation like that? Who is Diogo Pires? Is he a Jew who's being forced to hide and present himself as a Christian? Is he a Christian who feels this sense of inner Jew that he's trying to suppress or at least feed and keep on the side? Is he neither? is this converso actually a new spiritual being that has come into being, psychological, spiritual, right? So he was able, apparently, to successfully hold both sides of the candle until around 1525. But before we get to 1525, 1524 is a sensation sweeps the Italian community, Jewish community, and ultimately the entire Italian community, when David Haruvani arrives in Venice. He gets off a merchant ship, apparently, according to the description of the time, wrapped in a striped silk, or sorry, a white scarf, which he covered his head and most of his body, in a striped silk robe. It's from the letters of Daniel of Pisa, who was an important banker of the time, who became his translator and advocate. And the community of Venice is a little bit shocked by this short, swarthy Arabic, Hebrew, and Italian, no, not Southern Italian, Arabic and Hebrew-speaking Jew, who announces to them that he actually has come from Cairo, where he had traveled to from the far east, and he's the chief of staff of the army of 300,000 Jews, right, ruled by his brother Joseph. And these Jews are the descendants, he says, of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, three of the lost tribes living near the river Sambation. Now, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the idea of the 10 lost tribes, right? It's a concept that just won't go away. I mean, by the way, it won't go away largely because it's built into our prophetic consciousness. The place it shows up in the narrative of the Bible is, if you're familiar with the First Temple period, right, there was a unified kingdom under David and Solomon. Kingdom splits into the Southern Kingdom of Judah and Northern Kingdom of Israel. The Northern Kingdom of Israel is destroyed in 722 by the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrians were very effective at destroying their enemies, and their primary method was exile. They would take the people from here and move them over to there, where they'd conquer the people there, and they'd move them over to here. And why do you do that? Because of this idea of blood, God, and land, that people rooted in their soil still felt a loyalty to their God, which is what allowed them to keep their peoplehood together. So therefore, if you uproot them from their soil, and they will lose their God and just blend into the peoples of the world, which is why, of course, exile and the survival in exile plays such an important role in the story of the Yehuda, of the southern kingdom, the Jews. The northern kingdom, though, was the majority. In fact, historically, it was a much more powerful kingdom, by the by. But their exile, and then the subsequent descriptions in the book of Ezekiel, of the reuniting, because there was, some bad blood between the north and the south there, they're reuniting in the visions of Yechezkel as part of the redemptive process. I'm doing this because Yechezkel has a vision of two staffs. You write Yosef and Yehudah, and you put them together. The details are not critical for us right now, but from the moment that's written in the book of Yechezkel, it will reside in the messianic imagination of first the Jews, and then the Christians, because of course they adopt the Hebrew Bible as their own, that redemption is bound up with the reappearance of the 10 lost tribes. Right? And they're taken away to beyond this river Sambation. That's part of the story. Now, lest you think this is just nuts, let's not forget that we're in the midst of the great age of exploration. And I may not have mentioned to you, I can't remember, that the Portuguese in particular, as they're sort of rounding the Horn of Africa and circumnavigating the globe, are looking, they're looking for gold and silver and spices, and we'll talk more about that as we go on. But you know what else they're looking for? The kingdom of Prester John. Who's Prester John? Prester John is the Christian equivalent of the 10 lost tribes. Prester John is the legendary Christian king who lives past the borders of the Muslim Empire. Because remember, the Europeans experienced the world as Christian Europe here, the Muslim Empire here. And by the way, the Muslim Empire has all the stuff they want. All the spices, all the silks, all that stuff. Now, if we could just unite with the Christians who we believe live on the other side, we do a little pincer action and all that stuff will be ours. You know, see, it's and plus, of course, you know, the Redeemer will come again in 1,000 years of peace and all that. But the stuff will be ours too, which is very important. Right? I told you guys that Columbus mentions silver and gold 120-something times in his diary, and God only 26. Like, we got to get the proportions straight here. But, okay, so these Portuguese men, Portugal today is like maybe a cute vacation spot and an interesting language group. But at this point, it was the global empire, global sailing empire. So the Portuguese are traveling all over and sending back these very interesting reports about these strange peoples they're meeting all up and down the coasts of Africa and then ultimately in India. And stories of like Jewish communities begin to leak back, of Jewish communities in Kaifeng and different places in India and Bombay. Like, it wasn't Bombay yet, but whatever. And so it captures the imagination, not just that they may have actually either encountered the kingdom of Prester John, because as we'll see, the war between the Christians and the Muslims is heating up at this point as well, but also that means that redemption might actually be at hand. And I want you to hold this as the background. It's not just the story of Diogo Perez and his inner tension. Am I a Jew? Am I a Christian? Am I something new called a converso? This is a story of the Christian and Muslim worlds, which are once again at loggerheads. In 1529, the Ottomans conquer Hungary, and the Holy Roman Empire barely holds them off at Vienna. Right, and there's going to be another effort to muster troops to once again push them out of Hungary, out of what they consider to be Christian Europe. Right. Could have been, I don't know the details of European history that well. But that's politics. But you know what that is potentially in messianic terms? What's the great battle that precedes the return of the 10 tribes and the redemption? Gog and Magog. Right? Remember I told you that there's two ways to look at history? There's this sort of natural science, philosophical. Remember Shlomo Ibn Verga, who took this Sibat Tivi, this sort of natural causality from philosophy and science and applied it to history and said, don't tell me about Ferdinand as some tool in a divine prophecy. Tell me why it was to his financial and political advantage to kick the Jews out. He was the exception, not the rule. Right? Most people are looking at history as a typology. It's a playing out of a topography that was predicted by the prophets. And therefore, everyone's looking to see when's the battle going to happen. And it is just so tempting that Gog and Magog are the Christian world, primarily at this point the Holy Roman Empire, because they hold the greatest power in Europe, and the Ottomans, because they hold the greatest power in the Muslim Empire. Those who may have known and forgotten or didn't know, Constantinople, which was one of the crown jewels of Christian culture, fell to the Ottomans in 1453. And many historians, if you want to put a date on the beginning of the early modern period, that is it. The cannons that blasted the walls of Constantinople heralded the birth of modernity. But for the PX, that's all well and good to some historians sitting in an academic environment in the 19th or 20th century. What did they herald to the Jews who at that point were living under deep oppression? They haven't been kicked out of Spain. We know what they heralded? Well, freedom after what? The final battle. The final battle. So this is the context. So Diego Perez is not just fighting this battle within himself. He feels its grandeur happening in the world. On one hand, he's a Christian. On the other hand, he's a Jew. He's got that battle going on actually inside him. David Ruvani shows up in Venice, gets off the boat, by all accounts, dirt poor. The Venice community, not so thrilled to see him. Now, he gets off unaccompanied and starts asking for charity. They have a sense that this guy is going to be a problem, so they pay off all his debts and send him on his way to Rome. So somewhere along the way, he meets this sort of wealthy banker and translator, Daniel Pisa, who actually agrees to become his translator and through his connections with the church, gets him an audience with the Pope. You'd think that would be harder than it was, but apparently he was a very charismatic and impressive personality. And as I said, he comes to the Pope and he tells him that he was sent from the desert Kabul, right, from these 300,000 people of Israel there. This is quoting from a letter from Daniel Pisa, right, to make a treaty with the Pope and to ask him for weapons like Cortieri and Falconetti, where they're fire cannons and the like, to be delivered by the king of Portugal to a port named Jeddah, which is about a three-day journey to their own, the Jews' country, Tanitmos. He's come to trigger the final battle, and he wants the Portuguese, who are the military, at least maritime military power, of the region, to be the spearhead. So what's the Pope say? Yeah, I lose you? No, he's in Rome. He says to the Pope, because remember, the Pope is not just an ecclesiastic power. He's a temporal power. He's still the kingmaker of Europe at this point, although it's almost over with the rise of the Reformation, etc. We will speak about it by and by. What's the Pope say? Thumbs up, thumbs down? Pope says, what a great idea. I'll give you a letter to King John III of Portugal. It's astounding. To us, it's astounding. At the same time, you have to understand that the messianic predictions of these days, it's like every 20 years of somebody was predicting that the Messiah is coming in another 10 years. And so the dates worked out in the Pope's mind. Here's this guy who pops up out of nowhere, who looks the part, right? And just says everything you want to hear. And we can all scoff and laugh at the Pope and all, but let's not forget that when someone shows up and you are in a time of desperate, painful indecision, facing major obstacles, which you see to be personal or global redemption, and someone pops up out of nowhere, saying all the right things, looking right and radiating confidence, you know what most of us do? We listen, right? And that's exactly what the Pope does. The Pope at this point is Clement the Seventh. One second. Yeah, Clement the Seventh. Renaissance Pope. And don't forget, at this point, magic was science, right? So meaning the fantastic and what we think of as the rational have not been differentiated, even within sort of high European culture, which is where rationalism really gets its supercharge. So, okay, this is great. What does this have to do with Diogo Pires? Well, who's in Lisbon when David Ruvaini shows up with a letter from the Pope? I mean, you don't get a better calling card than that. Shows up with a letter from the Pope, want to speak to the king, and the king, of course, gives him an audience. And, you know, it's not quick. He shows up in 1525 and establishes himself in a household. He's being funded at this point. Nobody quite knows from where, but the Jewish community, sorry, there's no Jewish community. The Converso community, remember, the Inquisition's not there yet. So they are thrilled that the king of the Jews, as they begin to call him, has now appeared. He's allowed to practice outwardly as a Jew in the Iberian Peninsula, where arguably he is the only Jew in the entire peninsula who was permitted that privilege. Well, because he shows up with a letter from the Pope. You don't get more Catholic than the Pope, right? So there you go. He shows up, and talk about making waves. Making waves for the good and for the bad. Not everybody's so thrilled to see him. There are a lot of the conversos who would like to see him get out of town quickly before this ends poorly, right? There are a lot of the sort of practicing Catholics who see his Judaizing magnetism as drawing the new Christians away from the true faith. And then there are just a lot of politicians who don't like it when anybody shows up and suddenly has the ear of the king with a letter from the Pope who's looking to make war on some country that none of them have ever heard of with 300,000 mythical soldiers and the whole thing. I mean, again, there's got to be somebody in here who on the face of it says, is anybody else hearing this? This sounds absurd, right? Right, but you have to understand that what we take for granted, and this is why I warn you all the time, don't indulge in historical anachronism. What we take for granted as absurd or true is not what people necessarily took for granted as absurd or true 400 plus years ago, number one. Number two, you guys all nodded when I said to you, when you're faced with a deep dilemma, be it personal, professional, or national, and someone appears out of the blue saying that God himself has sent me and seems to have all the right answers, the pull to say yes, and they're all believers. And the Jew plays a funny role in the Christian imagination in that sense. Don't forget, all of them are aware that their Savior began his life as a Jew. They may not talk about it so much at this era, but the Jew plays a very funny role in Christian imagination down through the Middle Ages, which is one of the reasons that they don't just get rid of all the Jews, or at least try. Okay, so, but our story is actually about the personal reaction of Diogo Pires, because it can teach us a lot about the Jews of this time. So he reports later in one of his books that he goes on to write, I think it's Sefer HaKana, in my dreams I saw terrible visions, each different from the next, which struck me with fear. And the thrust of the vision I saw was to command me to become circumcised. So Diogo Perez approaches David Ruvaney, the only Jew in town, nominally, and says, help me, I want to become circumcised. And what does David Ruvaney say? No way. Get out of here, kid. You're going to blow my whole plan. From all reports, he accounts, he treats him coldly, distances himself. Why? Because the walls have ears. There may be no Inquisition, but as you guys all pointed out, they don't love this situation where there are people who are nominally Christian, but are truly Jew and are moving into their positions of power, right? So Ruvaney's no fool. He knows that he can't sort of like be involved in this, and he rebuffs Diogo Perez, who then decides to take matters into his own hands, literally. Yeah, he circumcises himself, barely surviving the act. Very bad idea. At the same time, he survives. He survives and emerges from this ordeal with a new name, Shlomo Mocho. Shlomo, his king. And you can imagine at this point, he's made his decision about whether he's a Jew or a Christian. Because he was convinced that Ruvaney wouldn't speak to him, wouldn't reveal his true mission to him because he was uncircumcised. Just as God says to Abraham, I'd like to get closer to you, but there's just one thing I need you to do. Right? And this notion, which, by the way, you might think is a deeply Jewish notion. It is a deeply Jewish notion. The Christians have the same notion too, right? The circumcision of the heart. See, the Jews had the physical circumcision, but they were unable to accept the Christian Savior because they had to circumcise their heart. So you see, actually, he hasn't entirely succeeded in getting out from under this question, is he a Christian or is he a Jew? He's definitely now practicing as Jew, which you can imagine doesn't go too well in his political position. And in fact, both he and Ruvaney, who despite his protestations that he had nothing to do with it, are sort of drawn into this controversy because he's not just some guy. He's a high official of the court, right? And so they have to flee. And where does a Jew flee, a new Christian who wants to practice as a Jew flee to at this point in history? Italy. You got to get out from under the Spanish-Portuguese rule, right? Ironically, Italy at this point, under the Renaissance popes, as we saw in our previous discussion, you remember many of these states are run by individual, they're city-states, and much of the rest of the peninsula is what we call the papal states. It's actually administered directly by the Pope, and they are, relative to the rest of Catholic Europe, liberal bastions. And so they flee to Italy, and they separate. They go their separate ways. They flee to Italy. Shlomo Mocho, at this point, apparently in Italy, begins to declare himself as the Messiah, son of Ephraim. Right. This is a concept you may have heard of, this idea that there's two stages to the Messiah. Mashiach usually said Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David, the Messiah son of Yosef, Messiah son of David. It's one can trace that split to the biblical origins. One could even tease it out of those prophecies of Yechezkel, as I told you. But I can tell you for sure that it becomes a popular notion with the rise of the sort of Girona school of mysticism in Iberian Jewish society, mostly in Spain, in around the 13th century. It becomes a popular notion. Where its origin is, I have not done sufficient research to tell you where it originates. But what's key is that there's a sacrificial element in their relationship, which many people find to be quite Christian. That the Messiah, son of Joseph, why does he say Ephraim? Because Joseph's two sons are Ephraim and Manasseh. The Messiah, son of Joseph, comes to pave the way for the true revelation of the Messiah, son of David, and that part of that paving the way is his death and then ultimate resurrection at the hands of the Messiah, son of David, who's going to come to resurrect the dead. Again, he hasn't quite freed himself from what sounds like fairly Christian tropes. But you know what those Christian tropes are riding on? Jewish concepts. You see, I told you guys, this is the era in which that very neat religious identity of us and them really begins to break down. And the cooker, the pressure cooker for that breakdown of identity, which we're still playing out today, I mean, I can't tell you, I once had a group, I was guiding a group of evangelical Christians in the city of David. And I remember I was in training at the time, and my supervisor, I was waiting for the group. Is that them? Is that them? No, no. He said, listen, you'll know when they get here. He said, they'll have that light in their eyes, right? So sure enough, this group comes walking up, and I said, that's them. He said, yeah, see? And the pastor, who happened to be a woman, greets us. So glad to be here. We see ourselves as a branch from your root. Like, I would get your branch off my root. Like, what? Like, I didn't even know how to react to that. But this instinct that there is, on one hand, a shared narrative, which I think personally is very important in terms of some of the healing that needs to be done there. On the other hand, the power dynamics between a majority culture and a minority culture, whichever you happen to be, where you're standing. Remember, she's the minority in that context. But globally, certainly not. Plus the bad blood of 2,000 years of persecution makes this very complicated. And much of it actually hits its inflection point really in this story. So he declares himself as the Messiah, Son of Ephraim, which apparently people don't find to be odd, because of the messianic ferment happening particularly amongst Italian Jews. This is, as I told you, it's a refuge. People are coming from all over. They're fleeing the German states because of the Reformation and the ugliness of the Lutheran persecutions that are happening there. There, anyone can get out of the Iberian Peninsula, be it Spain or Portugal. They're getting out of there, and they're headed for Italy. Even within Italy, there are expulsions, and you know, this duke is good to the Jews, that one's bad to the Jews. Remember, the multipolar world is not so happy for the Jews. They like the Pope, believe it or not. They like the Pope because the Pope is in charge, right? And so it's not so hard for people to believe that this guy is a precursor to the Messiah. And apparently he's quite eloquent, very learned, and has begun to put the pieces together of all those fragments of his learning that he had gathered. From the years of 1525 to 28, we kind of lose track of him. He's in Italy somewhere. He pops up again in 1529 in Salonica. You guys know where Salonica is? Well, careful, that depends on who you ask. Yes, it is in present-day Greece. It's on the Aegean Sea. Basically, it's not really facing Izmir because the Gulf actually faces away, but opposite Izmir. The reason I said depends on who you ask is, of course, if you ask the Turks, I promise you they'll say it's part of their land. But Salonica is going to play a very important role in another iteration of this story. Who else makes his name in the cities of Salonica and Izmir? What other messianic pretension? Shabtai Tzvi. Now, I want you to keep, those of you, if you don't know the story of Shabbat, it's fine, we'll tell the story. But those of you who do know the story, keep it in mind as I'm telling this, because it maps quite well with one notable exception. Okay, so he makes his way to Salonica in 1529. There in Salonica, he begins to preach, and he prints his point is the Ottoman Empire, which means he can be professing himself as a Jew safely. Remember, thank you for pointing that out, Chuck, is that the Ottoman Empire at this point is the safe base for the Jews. Italy is a transit point because it's unstable. Everybody who wants to live a Jew who's always been a Jew can live as a Jew. And we're going to talk about the fact that it's going to go downhill quickly in the later half of the 16th century, but you're still allowed to live as a Jew. The problem is someone who was a converso, who was a professing Christian, who is now seen not as a Jew, but as a recanting Christian, that's punishable by death, right? So therefore, in any Catholic country, which is most of Europe at this point, with the exception of a few German states that are starting to pull toward. A converso who tries to revert to their Jewish practice is considered a recanting Christian and is subject by the Inquisition to an inquiry, which generally doesn't end well. So he's now in Salonica in 1529, and there he actually publishes his major work, depending on who you ask, let's call it one of his major works. He publishes a number of books. It's very interesting. Clear, again, there used to be a narrative around Shlomo Molcho that he was just like, this is sort of like, that the converso world, they were ignorant, they knew nothing. It doesn't work, because the man was awing people with his knowledge, his eloquence, and his ability, which is very important, his ability to give a new and compelling presentation to the simple reading of biblical text and the mystical reading of biblical text. Now, why would that be? Why would it be that he had a unique ability to give a simple, unique presentation to the biblical text and the mystical text as read as one. It could have been the Christian. Could have been the Christian influence. It could have also been his personal experience of persecution. Don't forget that mysticism is a light that comes out of darkness. Almost universally, but certainly in Jewish tradition, it tends to emerge. Well, who's the great mystic of Jewish history? Whether you believe that he wrote the Zohar or not. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And where did he have his great revelation? In a cave fleeing Roman persecution. Right, burying his neck up to say, meaning that we have this notion that the mystic truths are those that are a light that comes out of darkness. And therefore, they can very easily bounce off, their understanding bounces off the average person who's living, I mean, listen, no Jew is living a life of ease in the 16th century in Europe. Not all of them are suffering under persecution. You know, Shlomo Molcho knows what darkness is. He also knows what we call Mesirat Nefesh. Mesirat Nefesh literally means to hand over one's soul. But we use it commonly saying that you have a self-sacrificing attitude. He's going to go for broke. And the man circumcised himself because he made an inner decision about the truth. You know, and you know, the ability to hear the truth with lies and complex, and I don't know how much experience people here have in sort of medieval mystic texts, but there it's a mythic language, it's extremely obscure, and in order to navigate it, you basically have to, what's a good metaphor? You have to move from one point of understanding to the next, which is true in all texts, right? Except if you're learning geometry, which would be the exact opposite, right? Once you accept the postulate, then you can build, like my daughter right now is trying to figure out, you know, side angle, side, and all that good stuff. I don't want to give anybody the creeps, but geometry, right? Once you absorb the postulates, the theorems makes perfect sense. And that's why I say to her, just get the basic pieces straight, and then you can figure out anything if you take your time. Right? So, by the way, mystical texts work in a similar fashion. It's just the postulates are not so easy to grasp. Because who are the archetypes behind the mythic language? What's the real message of the relationship between light and darkness? What's the key for unlocking, right, the meaning of certain statements which repeat themselves? So once he becomes convinced that he is able to understand these things, he unlocks them and people gather to hear him speak. And so in 1529, he publishes a book called Sefer HaMefo'ar, the Book of Magnificence, which apparently is a popular work at the time. He also there in Salonika meets the Alcibiades. Alcibiades is one of the great mystics and teachers of his day. He writes what? L'cha Dodi. Alcibiades will reappear in our story in Sfat, in the great, what's called the Golden Age of Sfat. We'll tell that story over a course of a couple of classes, don't worry. But the Alcibiades is no small rabbinic figure of his day. Also, according to some traditions, he meets the young Yosef Caro, right? Another exile from Spain, who at this point is already, he's not that young, but he's already becoming one of the world's leading rabbinic authorities. It's not clear that he actually met the Beit Yosef, but the Alcibiades is a documented reality. And in his experience in Salonika, he becomes convinced that indeed the time has come. Redemption is at hand. Remember, 1529, I'm pointing out to you, is the year that the Turks are stopped at the gates of Vienna, right? That the war of Gog and Magog has reached its climax, and that he, Shlomo Molcho, is the Messiah of Ben Yosef. He calls it Ben Ephraim. And therefore, he's got to take an activist stance. That's one of the very interesting things, because Shlomo Molcho is also Diego Perez. Shlomo Molcho is not some mystic rabbi who spent his entire life sheltered from the realities of the politics of his day. He sat in the highest court of the land and adjudicated law. He knows how politics work. He understands the relationship of the Pope, the Holy Roman Emperor, the King of Portugal, what the Turks are trying to achieve. So therefore, he sees himself uniquely positioned to what? Bring about Armageddon. And so he shows up back in Italy in 1530, preaching redemption, and he foresees a massive flood in Rome, and he predicts the appearance of a comet, and in early 1531, he says an earthquake will strike Portugal, which indeed it does. At this point, he is a prophet in people's eyes, including in the eyes of the Pope. The Pope gives him his personal protection, asks him for advice and insight, and gives him permission to live openly as a Jew. Remember, this is not David Ruvaini, who, okay, he wasn't allowed to live openly as a Jew in Lisbon because there were no Jews in Lisbon, so he had the Pope's protection. This is Diogo Perez ni Shlomo Molcho, recanted Christian, now living with papal protection in Rome. Why? Because everybody thinks he's a prophet, if not the Messiah. This is gaining a lot of momentum. So, what, I mean, the Pope thinks that he himself was chosen by God to lead the world. I mean, why is that so strange? Why would the Pope not believe someone who's telling him that he is about to lead Catholicism in the final battle? The Pope himself believes the final battle is coming. It's a matter of time. He believes he's on the side of right. He believes he is sitting in the seat of Peter. Therefore, he's God's anointed on earth. I mean, oh, everybody needs a prophet. Everybody needs a prophet. People, don't ever miss that. Everybody needs, because the Jews play that funny role in the medieval Christian imagination that we're onto something. We're onto something. We got this. I mean, I'll give you an example, and then you can just hold the question. But I'll give you a great example. The Visigothic Code. Let's go back to the 7th century, yeah? The Visigothic Code is one of the first complete codes of truly European law, as opposed to what's known as the Justinian Code, which was really Roman law. It has its roots in Visigothic culture, Iberian, pre-Christian Iberian, and then ultimately Christian Iberian culture. Why am I mentioning it? Because one of the things that the Visigothic Code has is a section of rules on the Jews. And one of the things it says there is that a Jew is forbidden to bless the field of any farmer. Which tells you what? That the Jews were blessing the fields of farmers. Now, I can't imagine the Jews woke up in the morning and were like, I'm going to bless Christopher's field. It was probably more like this. Christopher wakes up in the morning and says, ooh, crop's not looking good. Hey, Jew, I'll give you 10 gold pieces if you bless my field. Because the Jew holds this. And by the way, also, why did Pico de Mirandella think that the Kabbalah was the keystone to understanding, you know, what we call Priscia Theologia, pristine theology, which were the hidden secrets from Moses through Plato to him? And it was Kabbalah that was going to unlock it for him. Because within the Christian imagination, the Jew plays the role of the magic. And by the way, the magic can be the devil. We know how that goes. But it can also be the Savior. And I'll go back to it. There are a million plus Christians. You guys ever heard of the organization CUFI? Christians United for Israel? Right? I know some of these people fairly well. And the underlying principle that they work on is those who bless you shall be blessed. It's that simple. After 2,000 years of Christian persecution, they're looking at the rise of the modern state of Israel and saying, huh, I think we were wrong. God's on their side. I'm with them. Right? And that's actually not a deviation from a lot of very core Christian theology. And by the way, I'm not disparaging it. It's like, it doesn't hurt. Although you do want to always differentiate with how does that end? Which there are many, many evangelical Christians for whom it doesn't end with some sort of like the plot to convert all the Jews. And there are many for whom it does. So, by the way, you can always tell a good, solid piece of advice when you meet evangelical Christians, if you want to know sort of like which side of the line it's a question, do they want to talk or do they want to listen? No, if they want to listen, usually they're actually interested in the Jews. If they want to talk, you're a vehicle for something. That's not always true, but it's often true, I've found. Yeah, Avram.
He's
a prophet. By the way, I don't undervalue, like, he said there's going to be a flood in Rome, and the flood happened. He said there's going to be a comet, the comet happens. He said there's going to be an earthquake, the earthquake happens. At this point, everyone's like, this guy knows. Well, also because Shlomo Molcho is, what's he doing? He's telling him, he's reunited with David Ruvaini. What's he doing? What's he telling him to do? He's not telling him to recant and renounce Jesus and that. No, he's telling him, go to war with the Turks. Which anyway, let's not forget, sociopolitically, you know who else is about to go to war with Turks? Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor. So like, okay, go to war with the Turks. Everybody's telling me, like, all the cardinals are telling me to go to the war with the Turks. the king of Portugal and the Holy Roman Empire. So he also, my prophet tells me to go to the war with Turks. I told you, when people tell you what you want to hear, they sound very convincing. Right? In 1532, it's a very interesting. Just to give you like the further, his story draws into a legend very quickly. Why? Because at this point, Shlomo Ochel returns to Rome, I said, and he's making waves. He also, you know, you make waves, you make enemies. This is a truism, right? You know you're really getting somewhere in the world where people start to hate you. So in fact, even some amongst them are Jews, and they plot against him, and part of that plot is to send a letter to the Inquisition saying that basically this guy is not Shlomo Ochel. Remember, because we live in the information age, I just told you the whole story. The guy shows up as Shlomo Ochel in Rome. He's Shlomo Ochel, the Jew came from Salonika. He's not Shlomo Ochel, he's Diogo Perez, recanting Christian. That's bad news for the Inquisition. So the Inquisition gets a hold of this information. They indeed investigate and find it's true. Grab the wrong guy off the street, put him in prison, torture him. Eventually, you know, he'll say anything. Yeah, I'm the guy you want. And they execute him. And they go running to the Pope with this proof of his confession that his trusted advisor, Shlomo Ochel, is not only a recanted Christian and not only confessed, but he's now dead. And who should he find? Who should they literally find there with the Pope? Shlomo Ochel. Which gives rise to this legend that he's, in fact, cannot be killed. Right? So at this point, everybody's in awe. And who reappears? David Ruvaini. We don't know where he's been at this point. He got out of Portugal about as fast as he could. He's been wandering around as well. Again, it's not the information age. It's hard to trace his whereabouts. He shows up. They reunite in Venice. And they are aware that politically, like I said, in 1529, the Europeans had stopped the Turks at the gates of Venice. And now Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor, right, is in the process of gathering his troops to push one more time to get the Turks all the way out of Hungary. That's his goal. Now, Charles is very worried about the religious element in his army right now, because in 1532 now, the Protestant Reformation, the Lutheran heresy, depending on how you want to call it, right? And certainly the Holy Roman Emperor called it the Lutheran heresy, right? As now on its third decade. And it's starting to take off. And if you know anything about the history of the Protestant movement, it was a lot of the politics within the German state. The Holy Roman Empire, right, wasn't holy, wasn't Roman, wasn't empire, right? Discuss, right? It was made up, particularly in Central Europe, of counties, duchies, princedom, principality, cities, state. I mean, it's a mess. It's a mess, which will lead to the 30 Years' War that we'll discuss. But for now, he's just trying to hold everything together under one Catholic king. But what's happening is some of these small players have gone over the Lutherans, and you know what they're doing? They're opening up negotiations with the Turks, because they figure their enemy is actually the Pope and Catholicism. The Turks are nominally the tolerant culture of the day. I say nominally because everybody always, you know, you got to be careful of these presentations. Essentially, like, you know, if people are familiar with this notion of the golden age of Spain. I actually kept my mouth closed, but I was, sitting with, the golden age of Spain is a product in many ways of 19th century German Jewish historians who wanted to show how bad Christianity was and how good it could be elsewhere. But the flip side, which may or may not be true, I mean, because there was a convivencia, et cetera. So I sat with a student recently who was telling me how good life was before when Jews had a state, right? But then I sat in shul and listened to the rabbi of my shul, come on, let's salon, talk about how like the Arabs never did anything good for the Jews and we've always suffered under them. It's just quite ironic how you can tell whatever story you want and everyone will just nod their head. So at this point, the Turks are nominally the sort of more tolerant culture available. So some of these princedoms that have gone over to the Lutheran heresy are already opened up negotiations to see, well, it wouldn't be so bad if the Turks took over Central. Maybe if they'd won at Vienna. Because who's persecuting them? The Catholic Church. So Charles is quite nervous about any sort of religious cross currents within his army, because he's trying to recruit his army together. And at that point, David Ruvaini and Shlomo Ochel managed to appear in an audience with him. Again, how do they keep showing up in front of emperors? Because they got a letter from the Pope. That's the golden calling card. You got a letter from the Pope, you go wherever you want. So they come in, apparently according to story, carrying a sword and a shield, which is emblazoned on it, Mila Shemelai, right? Those who are for God, come to me, right? And they offer him divine magic aid in victory over the Turks. Right? Because why? Because at this point, they've realized that they can spark Armageddon. And this energy, this idea of what I call practical messianism, that you can actually, if you believe on one hand in the typography of history, right? Remember, Ezekiel already told you how it's going to happen. But he didn't tell you when. So there's a strange role that the human being can play, which is what? You can, like, make it happen. Kind of like in 1978 when Yehuda Etzion and a group of other Jews planned to bomb the Temple Mount, hoping to spark a final war that actually would bring about redemption. And by the way, whether you believe in God or not, that golden dome is basically a big gold button that says push here for Armageddon. I mean, you could do it if you wanted to. And so in the same way, Shlomo Molcho and David Ruvaini, who likely believed that they were indeed messianic figures, I don't really doubt that, and I think the end of the story proves itself out, appear in this audience, and listen, the Pope thinks that's true, right? Charles V, thumbs up, thumbs down? Thumbs down, you didn't read the board. Yeah, he's not buying it. And says, you're, in particular, Ruvaini gets thrown in prison and apparently is executed a few years later, but Shlomo Molcho, no, because he's a Jew, so it's less complicated, but Shlomo Molcho, he says, no, you're not a Jew, you're a recanted Christian, and I am the Holy Roman Emperor, and I don't really care if you have a letter from the Pope, right? Get out of jail free card. It doesn't work by me. And so they bind him hand and foot. They gag him because of his reputation for being able to say incantations and disappear. And at the last moment before they burn him at the stake, they uncover his mouth and ask him to confess that he is indeed a believing Christian, and he refuses. Swears his allegiance to God of Israel and to Judaism and the Torah, and dies a martyr's death in 1532. Emperor, please. That's a whole story of European history. The short answer is quite easily, actually. At this point, Charles V, there's nobody that powerful in Europe. It's true, later the empire will break up, and et cetera, but at this point, Charles V is arguably the height that the Holy Roman Empire ever reached. Now, dies.
Where was
it? That's a great question. Did I write it down? One second. No, he was. I don't think he was in Vienna. Hang one second. Hopefully I put it in my notes. Wait. Hang on. Both were peasant tribes of the Jews. In Mantua. That's where the audience with in Mantua. That's where the audience was. Yeah. I'm so glad I wrote it down. So the local results of this are nil. I mean, it doesn't change the state of the Jews, or frankly, the state of the conversos one way or another, right? The story here, though, I think illustrates for us a couple of very important points, and I want to just like put a finger on them. First of all, I told you guys the notable difference between his story and the story of Shabtai Tzvi. Again, if you don't know the story, that's fine. We'll tell it soon enough. What's the notable difference, though, for those of you who do know the story? He dies as a Jew. And that act of martyrdom, in the end of the day, is a decision between who was he? And that will serve to fire the imagination. You know, Yosef Karo, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who, like you said, may or may not have met Shlomo Molcho in Salonika, goes on to become arguably the greatest religious figure of early modernity. Perhaps, you know, he's definitely on the list of ever. The writes, if you're not familiar, he's the author of the Shulchan Aruch, as well as the author of the Beit Yosef commentary on the Torah, as well as the Kesef Mishnah. One of his lesser-known works is what's known as the Magid Misharim. The Magid Misharim is his spiritual journal. Spiritual journal, it's called the Magid Misharim because a Magid is what? A storyteller, that's what it becomes into the Hasidim. What's a Magid to the Mechaber? It's a little angel that sits on his shoulder and tells him what the law is. And this vision tool, which he apparently had access to on a regular basis, told him that should he continue on his path of righteousness, he would merit a martyr's death just like Shlomo Mocho. That Shlomo Mocho will exist as a powerful archetype in the converso imagination of someone who actually got out of the trap. Because, you know, making clear decisions on one's identity is not so simple. Right? At what point was Shlomo Mocho able to really know who he was? Only really in the last moment. And after all, what was he doing? Courting the Pope. It's a little bit strange, looking for approval in the highest echelons of Catholicism. Why didn't he just flee? What was this messianic tension? Why didn't he stay in Salonika, write works of mystic significance like the Alcabets, right? Move to the land of Israel if he's the Messiah and await the redemption there, like his later, you know, inheritors like the Arizal. He was not the only one who had these messianic pretensions. Part of it was because of this inner tension that the role that the Jew had taken vis-a-vis the world up to now, which was us here, them there, was no longer indicative of his inner state of being. And that's going to be very important for understanding this power of the converso consciousness. So I want to actually speak that out a little bit more. And then, depending on where we get, there's another major story on the line. I mean, maybe we shouldn't tell two stories in one day, but they're all in my notes here, so we'll see what we get to. Questions or comments? Yeah, Peter.
Did he write about that inner conflict?
The books that we have that I've seen, did I write down any of the quotes? No, you know, it's not so much. I'm read extensively. Also, he didn't write so much autobiographically as he wrote sort of about his mystic insights, although there are autobiographical comments like the one that I shared with you there. There's been a lot of attempts to recover, and there's a couple of books even out about him as a person, which are worth looking at.
It was Manuel III, Portugal.
Yeah.
It was the Battle of Mohacs against.
Well done.
And that's what is in
Italy. Yes.
Wait, you said that?
No, I didn't say where it was, but Manuel II, I'm sorry. I thought everybody's read Romeo and Juliet, right?
No, but Charles V had that. Wait, he was part of his territory, not the Pope.
Wasn't part of the Papal States, yes.
Okay.
A little bit. Yeah, sorry. Oh, sorry. Yeah, there's only so much of your penis that I can present. So that's what I meant when I said he could defy him like that. Okay. Great. Great. Excellent. So. Well, I mean,
it's illustrative, but
why am I telling the story? Because of this idea of the converso consciousness that I want to speak out, because that is going to make, ultimately, you know what the biggest impact that the converso consciousness is going to make on Jewish and arguably human history is in Spinoza, right? And so I want, what I'm doing is setting up the birth of modernity, which modern philosophers will pin the birth of secular modernity at least not, if not entirely on Spinoza, largely on him. And he is a sort of like pre-move hoc. He's a choice fruit of this type of process.
But the converso story, is it unique to Spain and Portugal, or can we go back to the Romans and the Greeks and the Babylonians? Is there something?
It really comes into being here. Uh-huh. Really comes into being here. Okay. Yeah, because also because of the nature, as we're going to, I'll speak more about it in terms of the socio-political context and the context of the technology of transportation and communication. It's also going to play a very important role in the story of Shabtai Tzvi and the spread of that heresy, which itself gives birth to many other things. So this is part of the setup. Plus, it's just a good story, which is, you know, always worth telling. It doesn't hurt.
No, I keep thinking, but surely it's something that we can all identify with.
In what sense?
It's not only that it's a modern story, which is what it's the case. There
In many ways, I would argue that the Converso consciousness is the seeds of postmodern culture, in the sense of the ultimate individualization of identity and the assumption that identity is something which is experienced and not necessarily shared by definition. So therefore, one will always live, to some degree, an inner life which is not reflective of their outer life. Now, you could say that's a part of human psychology, as always has been. I wouldn't argue with that, right? I mean, the stages talk about the need to be chad b'peh b'chad b'lev, right? We have a recognition that your inner life and your outer expressions are not always going to map. But the question here is that, like I said, was he Diego Perez? Was he Shlomo Mocho? Or was he actually something entirely different that emerges out of the two of them? Right, and that's where I want to speak more about the Conversos as a whole community. And we'll leave the story of Daniel Gracia for next week. Yes.
And so they did things in their own homes. What's always made me wonder a little bit was, did they trust their fellow Conversos? In other words, was there any linkage amongst all of these people?
So we're gonna speak more about the emergence of what's known as the Nacio, right? The Hebrews of the Portuguese, sometimes Portuguese and Spanish nation. But yeah.
You're still talking about, it's not all that well known among Ashkenazi, at least as far as I know.
No.
I
don't know. I don't know. That's a question in what's called the history of reception. How is this event received down through generations and preserves? I don't know, actually. Yes. Yes. Many, I mean, you guys are probably familiar with the fact also that both Spain and Portugal have tried to sort of make amends, as it were, by offering citizenship to the descendants of Conversos. Listen, the Jews, and it's happening again in America, by the way. The Jews have always amalgamated with the sort of majority cultures within which they found, and have generally been a significant contribution to that culture. But it comes at a high price, right? One of the hallmarks of modernity, which we'll speak about when we get there, is that the entry port of modernity for the Jews was you must check your culture at the door. Yes, for sure. By the way, the USSR as a converso consciousness is an excellent example. I'll tell you a quick story. A friend of mine was speaking to a group of Israeli Arabs, and actually Palestinians, about the challenge of living under the Palestinian Authority. You may or may not know the Palestinian Authority is not exactly a liberal democratic institution. This friend of mine is himself, he's actually native-born Israeli, but his parents were refuseniks, Russians, and his mother, God bless her, comes to everything he does. So his mother was in the audience, and these Arabs were basically there to try to get chizuk, like, how do we live like this? And at a certain point, one of them stood up and said, like, okay, we all agree that, like, we live under this oppressive regime. You're telling us that you want to help us, but you can't. So, like, what do we do? How do we continue to live? And he didn't know what to say. And his mother raised her hand. And she says, she's a little old Russian Jewish lady, right? Says, when we lived under the Soviets, we just refused to believe that any of it was real. You go about your daily life, and you don't believe any of it's real. And eventually, it all went away. So you see that is really another expression of this Converso consciousness. I'm going to maintain my inner reality. Just think about, Nathan Sharansky is probably arguably the most famous refusnik, right? The most powerful empire in the world put him in prison. Did he try to break out of prison? No, he just waited until the empire crumbled around him. Yes. No, of the PA. Meaning, like, we want freedom. We want to live a normal life. Like this one guy in the interfaith group that I somewhat involved in said, I want to be able to just go jogging in shorts through my neighborhood. And yeah, it can get that bad out there. It can get that bad. So this relationship to the political, cultural, religious system within which we live, and by the by, you can extend this in many places. I won't point any fingers, but I can tell you that in my religious community, there are definitely a number of conversos. I might be considered one of them. And I'll sit in shul, and it looks like I'm like everybody else. Am I really? What's going on inside me? Is it the same thing that's going on inside the next guy? These guys that are happy to have me daven from the Amud on Shacharit, if they started asking me theological questions, would they be so happy? You know, like, you know, it's a complex existence. Okay, so on that note, just take the last few minutes here to lay out two critical pieces of the converso existence. First of all, I had this note to myself to tell. I remember. I hope you guys have all heard Rabbi Riskin speak, right? One of the great speakers of our day, and a super mensch, you can fill in the blank with everything else. But I'll never forget he was my Rosh Hashiva for a while, and once before Shir, he was telling us that, you know, my whole life I was a Jew. I had to come to Israel to become an Anglo-Saxon. Right? If you know Rabbi Riskin, you can picture him saying that, I'm sure. So in many ways, the experience of what becomes the Portuguese, the Hebrews of the Portuguese nation, is the same. When they're in Portugal, they're new Christians, or they were Jews and then new Christians. Once they get out, and we're going to speak next week the story of Dona Gracia as sort of like one of the sort of archetypes of structures of how do they actually get out. Once they get out, they're different than the other Jews. They're different both because of their language group, they're different because of their life experience, they're different because they don't necessarily have the sort of like halakhic etiquette of rabbinic life, right? It seems they're in Jewish company. Everybody steps left, they go right. It's awkward, you know? And they therefore, in many ways, will form their own community, which is known as the Nacio, the Hebrews of the Portuguese nation, sometimes Portuguese and Spanish. It's usually spelled that wonderful A in Portuguese. Hey, can somebody say it properly? Yeah, like I said, my Portuguese is rusty. But so it's important just to like map it out a little bit. This forced conversion, the king promises them there will be no persecution, don't ask, don't tell, for 20 years. And he extends it by another 20 years in 1512. But the Pope was not so into that. And in 1536, the Inquisition indeed sets in. And so it's really from 1536 that you get an erosion of the Jewish culture, which largely has a facade of Christianity over it. Except it's not that simple. Because for every Diogo Pires who saw David Ruvaini in 1524, there were 10 guys who said, I don't have nothing to do with that. Life is good. Right? Life is good as a Christian. And if my particular way of being a Christian is to light candles on Friday night in a room with no windows, or to wash my hands before I eat bread, or I have some specific sort of counter charm I say when I take the communion in church, like all these practices that were developed by an underground culture, which is outwardly participant in the majority culture, but inwardly defiant, that's going to be a hallmark. Outwardly participant in the majority culture, but inwardly defiant, right? So, but that doesn't mean that I necessarily want to jump ship, especially not when, of course, as I pointed out to you, the royalty is trying to draw these Jews into the upper echelons of royal service because they're useful. So the question is that, you know, but even though it took until 1536 for the Portuguese Inquisition to kick in, the borders are still mostly sealed, mostly, as we'll see next week, and Hebrew books are banned. So therefore, the knowledge base is extremely hard to maintain intergenerationally, right? Remember, Diogo Pires is born in 1501, right? He's born to parents who were only forcibly converted 4 years ago. That means they're Jews. You know what we call them? Their knowledge base is Jewish. Their possessions, I mean, you might ban Jewish books, but I don't know that they went house to house and right, so you teach him orally, fine, but his generation, who do they teach, and how do they do it? Right, and this is what begins to happen. But what emerges is an amalgamation. Again, first of all, outwardly conformist, inwardly defiant. Remember that because it's, well, I'll just make it express. What's going to happen to someone whose relationship to culture and religious structure, outwardly conformist, inwardly defiant, when you drop them in the middle of, let's say, rather constrictive rabbinic culture. You understand? You spend your whole life, your Jewish identity is built on an underground culture. What it means to be a Jew is to defy the structure around you. Outwardly conformist, inwardly defiant. Okay, you get your freedom. Woohoo! You go to Amsterdam. We'll tell the story of Amsterdam. You go to Amsterdam, and you're so happy to be here. I want to be a Jew. And people start saying, okay, well, you do it this way. You don't do it that way. And say, I was watching you in shul today. You don't, no, no. And, oh, by the way, that kitchen, no, no, not this in the kitchen. And, like, you know, you can't talk to that girl. And, that outwardly conformist, inwardly, it's not just culture shock, that outwardly conformist, inwardly defiant relationship doesn't go away. Furthermore, you have bled and died for your identity. All these other Jews out there who are telling you what it means to be a Jew is to keep the Shulchan Aruch. For you, what it means to be a Jew is to risk your life to wash your hands before you eat bread. Or to, you know, secretly pass on bits of knowledge. Right? So you're don't see yourself as a second-class Jew, though the people who are judging by rabbinic standards may. Oh, yes. Yeah. Not only that, but just think about it. If the only thing you ever did to express yourself as a Jew is to light candles on Friday night in the basement, and you finally get free, and explicitly or implicitly, everyone's telling you, listen, you're not such a good Jew. All you do is light candles in the basement on Friday night. And what are you going to say to them? My family bled and died and risked its life for three generations to light candles in the basement. Don't tell me I'm not a Jew just because you don't mix milk and meat. Right? So you understand where there's a collision course developing here between normative, religious, rabbinic structure and a community which begins to self-identify as its own Hebrews of the Portuguese nation, which is not so interested, by the way, who dominates. We're talking about the Ashkenazi world right now. Who dominates the non-Ashkenazi, the Sephardi world? I'm going to give it away by saying it. It's the Spanish high culture, who you would think they would nominally meld very easily together because the Iberian cultures, it's true, they're different languages, but they're quite close, right? But the reality is, in most places where they can, the Portuguese will maintain their conversal communities, will maintain their own communities. Amsterdam is probably the best example, also Antwerp. They'll come into our story later. Northern Europe at this point, Atlantic states, extending all the way into the New World, because it will be the conversos, along with the Spanish Jews, but it'll be the conversos who form many of the earliest Jewish communities on the Atlantic seaboard of the New World, right? These are places of relative religious liberalism. So now what happens is that instead of them becoming officially rabbinized, many of them will become Europeanized. Because in Amsterdam, the value of religious tolerance is a classic value of you do you. That doesn't really float so well with the rabbinic attitude on Judaism. We're not into you do you. We're into you do the Shulchan Aruch. Right? And at this point, rabbinic power is expressed through tools of social exclusion, right, called excommunication, right, through sort of like takanot, like, you know, the communal injunctions, right? And so you can see there's a clash with rabbinic power on the horizon. There's other very important elements of this religious consciousness that one of the ways in which the Inquisition actually sought power over the Jews through, say, from the 14th or 15th century, really earlier onwards, because remember, the Inquisition has no power over the Jews in the Catholic world. The Inquisition has power because of the Catholic Church and because of the cooperation of the Catholic monarchs wherever they are. Power over whom? Catholics. Catholics. The king has power over everybody. In the medieval model, the Jews were actually serfs of the king, which led to a lot of the conflict between kings and the church, because the church wanted to get at the Jews, but the king often wouldn't let them. But even theologically, the Inquisition is an office for the purity of the Catholic faith. It has nothing to do with Jews. It's a misconception. The Inquisition did not persecute the Jews, by and large, in Spain. The Inquisition persecuted the new Christians. And to the extent that they found the Jews were a problem, that's why they had the king kick them out. Judaizing, yes, but they were concerned about them, but they didn't have power over them. The king had power over them, which is why their solution to, they couldn't fight, they couldn't keep the new Christians on the path as long as the Jews are around Judaizing. But they couldn't get rid of the Jews themselves, so what did? They had the king expel them. That was the solution. And by the way, in Spain, it largely worked. I mean, unlike in Portugal, where they maintained an integrity of Jewish consciousness and eventually were able to escape, the Jews that were left, the new Christians that were left in the Iberian Peninsula were almost completely erased. Yeah, in Spain. Almost completely erased. Right? So, but one of the ways in which the church sought power over the Jews as Jews was by claiming that the Talmud itself was a source of heresy. So the Jews, rabbinic Jews, are heretics. And therefore, fall under the capacity of the Inquisition. Now this may sound like sophistry to you, but I want you to understand that what these new Christians are hearing is the church saying over and over again, the Talmud is heresy. The Talmud is heresy. The Talmud is heresy. They're not real Jews. They're not real Jews. People in the position of religious authority, they're not real Jews. Now, by the way, I don't know if you've ever tried to learn any Talmud, but to do so on your own is probably a waste of time if you've never opened it. Right? To just pick up a Talmud and try to read it and extract anything meaningful from it is less than pleasant. Well, but our school didn't exist at this time, right? And so therefore, the loss of detailed rabbinic culture, not necessarily knowledge, because knowledge can be passed down mimetically, right? I do it because my parents did it, but that has to be an underground culture, and we saw where that goes. But the loss of the knowledge is fairly rapid. We saw it's not immediate, because Diego Pérez was still holding a fairly high standard. We have other evidence that it doesn't ever really disappear, and, you know, people are still traveling in and out of Portugal, like the borders aren't truly sealed, etc. But nevertheless, what you're going to get is the emergence of a Judaism which sees faith in the Torah of Moses as the ultimate expression of Judaism. An inner faith in the Torah of Moses as opposed to the adherence of halakha, of practice. Now, what does that sound like, faith as opposed to works? Catholicism particularly. Catholicism, faith over works. Right? This is a classic problem that every revolutionary has to face. If any of you see yourselves as revolutionaries, you should take it to heart. Is that you want to be careful not to define yourself by that which you oppose. It is a very difficult challenge to overcome. Right? In opposition, you find definition. So therefore, they're opposed to the Catholic Church, but in their opposition, they're asserting their faith in the Torah of Moses as opposed to their faith in Jesus of Nazareth. Well, I got news for you. The rabbinic culture is not about faith. It's about actions. It's not that faith is irrelevant, but it's not the definitive characteristic. But the conversos will then be carrying a culture in which faith in the Torah of Moshe is definitive, which is going to be part of the general erosion of Jewish practice, which is on the horizon in modernity. Right now, you've got a general contrary attitude toward power structures and the assumption that you're going to outwardly conform and inwardly defy. You have a low level of knowledge and some skepticism about whether these rabbis are really actually Jews. And you have a deep, baked in over generations sense that really what matters is your faith in the Torah of Moses and not necessarily in what you do. Now that's a culture that may sound somewhat familiar in terms of certain Jewish attitudes even today. Right? The last and perhaps most important piece for our story is that the communal history of martyrdom, underground struggle, inner defiance, all these things leads to a deeply messianic culture. Deeply messianic culture. So there's a record from the Inquisition from a Catholic priest named Andre Bernaldez already in the 15th century. He says, all of them, speaking about the new Christians, all of them clung to their hope like the Israelites in Egypt, that God would lead them out from the midst of them. So too the conversos looked upon the Christians as Egyptians or worse. They held steadfastly to their faith that God would guide and remember them and bring them out from the midst of the Christians and lead them to the holy and promised land. That sounds great, right? Well, the problem is that that's very dramatic. What happens When you get out of Portugal and you end up in Amsterdam, and it's not redemption, it's daily life. It's saying Shema twice a day, it's laying tefillin, it's not eating pork, it's fasting on Yom Kippur. Anybody getting tired yet? Right? There is a messianic expectation which is built into their identity as Jews, which remains unfulfilled. Remember Shlomo Mocho. He found his fulfillment in martyrdom. Right? And that will make them ripe for another messianic figure to come along. And when Shabtai Tzvi's messianic movement sweeps the world, the ready tinder that his fire will find will be the conversos. For many, many reasons that we'll revisit when we get there. About 1660, call it. Shabtai Tzvi? Yeah, and we will tell his story at length. I'm just only referring it to here because in many ways it's the culmination of the process that I'm describing. Yeah.
You're not talking about the Jews who went to the Netherlands, are you? Like the conversions, because they had a different environment.
Oh, well, we'll see what happens in the Netherlands. There's been a lot of very interesting research in the Amsterdam community about what exactly was going on there. Spinoza comes out of that community. Rav Menashe ben Israel also comes out of that community. We will spend quite a bit of time in Amsterdam. Don't worry. So the last piece I'll just throw out there to keep in the mix is that the conversos, in particular the Nacio, this sort of far-flung community, and remember this community is still in Portugal. Many of them stay there. Many of them will escape, and some will make it to places where they can practice as Jews. Some will escape and make it to places where it's safer to be a converso, but not necessarily safe to practice as a Jew, or maybe they actually identify as a converso, remember? That is a real identity after all. Some of them are going to be practicing Christians. Some will be monks, nuns, family, friends, brothers, sisters. It's a very complex community, very similar to many Jewish communities today, right? And will be flung across the world because, of course, this is the great age of exploration. And so the sort of last sort of archetype I'll put up there, and we'll pick up with this next week in the person of Dona Gracia, probably the second most powerful Jewish woman in history next to Queen Esther, that there's an archetype that really is being characterized, I think it's in the 80s, I think the first papers started to characterize it, of the port Jew. People are probably familiar with this phrase, the court Jew. And when we come back to Ashkenazi culture, we'll speak about court Jews. But right now, I want to offer you this idea of a port Jew. Who is the port Jew? Right? Port meaning like a port of entry. Like right? These are the men who, almost entirely men, although Dona Gracia is an exception, who were able to capitalize, pun intended, on the mercantilist system that's emerging in the 16th century. Remember, Europe is colonizing rapidly every piece of territory they can get right now. Right? And the basic principle of what they're doing is exploiting local resources, shipping them back to the mother country, manufacturing them into finished products, and selling them back to the colonies. That's basically the way mercantilism works. We'll speak more about it next week. But in order to do that, you know what you need? Middlemen. You need merchants. You need people willing to take risks, front capital, know how to operate internationally, right? And lo and behold, and people, by the way, ports are, of course, notoriously liberal places, right? You want to get away with living your own lifestyle? You're better off in a port, especially better off in a port when your wealth and political connections means nobody wants to really ask too many questions. And so there will be, and I will speak much more about it next week, but just dropping it as the last comment here, there will be a sort of new category of lay leadership or just simply sort of nonconformist personalities that emerge out of the sort of intersection between the search of the conversos for both religious and personal freedom, as well as identity, and the great age of exploration and mercantilism that allows them to create a financial and mercantile network which spans the globe. And these personalities are going to play a very important role in our unfolding story. We'll pick up with Dona Gracia next week. Thank you.
This was a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To learn more about sponsoring a podcast, please contact Jamie at pardes.org.